Before we hop into today's episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Get yourself out of the weeds. Operations, multiple systems, all just to deliver your product or service, are probably just cutting into your margin, not to mention your time. Plus, with expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing rising, everything costs more these days. So you can reduce your costs and headaches by just graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. You can reduce your IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, and you can access it from anywhere. Cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems. Go from many to just one. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have made the move. NetSuite is a proven way to cut costs and boost performance at the same time. And to me, that's a pretty smart move. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/SPI, netsuite.com/SPI. That's netsuite.com/SPI. Hey, we have an amazing event coming up, the Expert Advantage Workshop Series, where every day for a week, starting on Monday, May 20th, it's myself and another expert coming on to present to you about various kinds of things to help you with your brand and your business. Our brand new experts in residence and pro are going to be there to co-host these workshops with me, and you're not going to want to miss it. You'll have a chance to ask all of them questions, and it's completely free to join. All you have to do is go to smartpassiveincome.com/advantage. On Monday, May 20th, Amy Nelson's going to come on, and we're going to talk social media, but specifically how to drive revenue and connect with important stakeholders that matter to you in your business using social media. The next day, we have Nosheen Chen, and she's going to lead a presentation about how to become a better communicator, how to increase those skills faster, because that's going to help you not just connect with new people, new clients, but also get your idea across better. Ton of takeaways in that presentation. And all you have to do to sign up and join and get all the links that you need is smartpassiveincome.com/advantage. Again, one more time, smartpassiveincome.com/advantage. Join us on our Expert Advantage Workshop Series. You're not going to want to miss it. Again, smartpassiveincome.com/advantage. This is the Smart Passive Income Podcast with Pat Flynn, session number 75. Chugga. Psh. Chugga. Ah. Chugga. Psh. Chugga. Ah. Chugga, chugga, psh. Chugga, chugga, ah. Chugga, chugga, psh. Chugga, chugga, ah.
All aboard the choo-choo train. All aboard the choo-choo train. All aboard the choo-choo train. All aboard. All aboard the choo-choo.
Welcome to the Smart Passive Income Podcast, where it's all about working hard now so you can sit back and reap the benefits later. And now your host, he loves listening to the bonus commentary on DVDs, Pat Flynn.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is the place to go hire. It's your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data. And their matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast so you don't have to spend hours and days searching manually. Ditch the busy work of hiring. Indeed includes a suite of tools for scheduling, screening, and messaging all in one platform, and you'll connect with candidates much faster. But it's not just about speed. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And I've hired before, and I gotta say, anything that can be made easier in the process is great. And Indeed exactly does that for you. So if you need to hire, I would go with Indeed ASAP. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/smartpassive. Just go to Indeed.com/smartpassive right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/smartpassive. Terms and conditions apply. You need to hire. You need Indeed. Yo, yo, what's up? This is Pat Flynn, and welcome to session 75 of the Smart Passive Income Podcast. That's 3/4 of the way to 100, which is awesome. Now, thank you so much for listening today. I really appreciate it. Quickly, if you can tell me where that intro song comes from, I will give you a virtual high five. Or if you'd prefer a virtual cookie, you can tell me which one you want. But anyway, have I got a good show for you today? Today, we're bringing on a special guest who has an incredible story that all leads to what he's doing right now, which is awesome. He's making 6 figures a year writing books. And these aren't Amazon Kindle books. These are self-published books, ebooks, selling them off of his own website. And he did this in a relatively short period of time with a relatively small email list. And he's going to share exactly how it all happened today. He's very transparent, shares all of his numbers, which, as you know, I love. And this is the kind of stuff that's just amazing, because, you know, they always say that you can't make too much money selling books. You know, it's just a lead into something bigger. Or sometimes they say, you know, it's just a giant business card to help you land clients and things like that. Well, this episode will prove the otherwise. You know, also included are some very specific pricing strategies that this guest shares for your books and or products that you're selling off of your website. So everyone, let's welcome none other than Nathan Berry from NathanBerry.com here on the SPI podcast. What's up, Nathan? How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, Pat.
Of course. We're so happy to have you here. You know, I've just started to hear your name everywhere now, and I see that you're creating these books and just your design is amazing, and we're going to get into all that. But before we start talking about that stuff, why don't you just introduce yourself to the SPI podcast audience really quick and sort of just tell us who you are, what you do, and sort of how you got there.
Yeah, so I went to school for graphic design in college.
Okay.
And I lasted all of one semester.
Nice.
And then I switched to marketing and did some business stuff and lasted three more semesters before dropping out. Wow. And the reason I dropped out is I learned that I could make money freelancing. And I did that all through college, like doing freelance web design for, you know, a bunch of different local companies. And I got to the point where I was actually making a decent amount of money, you know, at least for I was 17 at the time. And so working on $4,000, $5,000, $7,000 projects was quite a bit of money, and I liked making money more than spending money going to school. So I dropped out, spent a year after that freelancing fairly successfully. And then things changed for me when I went on a 5-week extended trip to South Africa, and had a wonderful time, great trip. And I came back, and it was January 2009. And I went to get, you know, follow up with everybody, all my clients, see who was ready to do some work, because I had plenty of leads in the pipeline. And basically nobody wanted to do work. They were all waiting for their clients to spend money. Mm-hmm. And so I came back, hadn't made money in 5 weeks. I wasn't that great with finances back then. And so I was kind of like, shoot, what am I going to do? And one of my clients offered me a job to come on and lead their software design team. And they were just a 14-person company at the time. And I decided to come on full-time with them. And I actually spent 3 years there with them. Learned a ton of stuff. Watched that company grow up to 90 people. And then got to watch it shrink on the other side. So it was a good experience. And I learned a lot. But then in October 2011... I left that job. It was one of those things where they'd had three rounds of layoffs and I still had my job. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I need to leave on my own terms. And so it just told me, you know, it was time to go. And so I left my job to go back to some freelancing. I'd also built an iPad application at the time that was making a couple thousand a month. And so that was kind of a nice baseline income to help support my freelancing. And I guess when I moved back to doing contract work, I referred to myself more as a consultant than a freelancer because mm-hmm. I had a lot more experience. I'd done some work for some big international brands at that time. And, you know, I'd learned a lot in the process. And so I made more money and enjoyed being self-employed a lot more after, I guess, the second time around I tried it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit. You started off freelancing, and I think, you know, a lot of people ask me the question, well, Pat, like, how do I build a business? What should I do now? I need to make money soon. And typically the answer I give them is, you know, yes, you want to work for yourself eventually, but I think the best way to start to do that is to start freelancing. That way you could put yourself in that industry and start to meet people, whether they're clients or people that you're working, who you were working for. And that's how you got connected with one of your clients eventually and became a part of this design team of this company. I think that speaks really highly of that sort of strategy, if you want to call it that, to, you know, just get your foot in the door. And then you just start to get more experience. You start to meet even more people. And, you know, that led you to, you know, where you're at now, which is designing, you know, a whole bunch of stuff, which I want to get into. But, you know, what would you say about, you know, the path from sort of freelancer to entrepreneur? How has that been? And how would you, you know, respond to that same question? Do you feel like that's a good answer? How do I start my own business and I need to make money soon?
I think freelancing is a great way to go. It forces you to start building up connections. It forces you to find out exactly how good your skills really are. It can be easy to, you know, be in your own little world a little bit, or even within a company, mm-hmm. and you're set in a groove and you're working away and that's fine. But once you get out and start freelancing and working with a bunch of companies, then you get a lot more, I guess, frequent feedback of like, how good of a designer are you? How good of a marketer are you really? Right. And so that can be helpful. You also get exposed to a ton of different situations and problems instead of just being, you know, looking at the few problems that the company you work for is experiencing. If you work for 10 different, you know, you do contract work for 10 different companies over the course of a year, then that's a ton of new people that you meet, which can turn into other opportunities, and it's a ton of problems that you get exposed to. So I think freelancing is great. The immediate income is also wonderful.
Right. And I think it's cool that, you know, like you said, you can have multiple clients or people that, you know, you're working with. And what happens is you might connect with one of them like really, really well, and you might team up with them. You know, I've seen that happen way too many times, you know, people really connecting with the people that they're doing contract work for. And then they start to build a team from there. And you know, it's sort of amazing what can happen. What are some of the, you know, I'm just trying to imagine if I was just starting out and I needed to make money now. And I wanted to freelance, you know, how would I do that? Like, how do I even know I have the skills to do that? Or even if I did have a skill, like, where would I go? Should I sign up for Elance and be a developer on Elance? Or, you know, is that how you approached it? Or do you just start making phone calls and offering your services? Like, what's the route for a beginning freelancer?
I would start with your personal network. So if you start to get a skill and, you know, you need to practice a lot yourself. And so, but if you start to get relatively good at something, people will naturally ask you for help with that. And that may just be friends and family, asking you for basic stuff, like, will you design this poster for me, or, mm-hmm. you know, all kinds of other things like that. But people will notice your skills and start to ask for help. And, you know, they're asking for free help. But that's a good way to identify what other people think you're good at. And then, you know, once you decide that you want to do some freelancing from that, then it's just a matter of actually going around identifying who you know that has a need of your skills, and then just directly asking them. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of people who kind of beat around the bush and say, I'll let people know in vague terms that I do this thing, and hopefully they'll want to hire me. And you can do that, but it's going to take a whole lot more time. You'd be better off contacting people directly and, you know, saying, hey, I'd love to work with you on this project, and going through that sort of thing. And if you get rejections, at least you're getting that feedback right away. And people will usually tell you, sorry. They may give you an excuse like, I don't have work for you right now, which often isn't true. Mm-hmm. But often if you push for it, they'll give you really real feedback like, I don't think your design skills are good enough, or I don't think you have the experience to be a developer on my team, or, you know.
Right, exactly. And you could take those questions and
learn from them. I mean, if someone says, oh, well, it doesn't look like you have that much experience, well, then you didn't do a good job of showing people how much experience you had. And maybe that's when the whole doing stuff for free stuff happens. And, you know, to build your portfolio, it sort of reminds me of a photographer, one of my friends. The way he got started was he just started doing free work for people, you know, shooting baby pictures and engagement pictures for them just for free. And now he's doing really well. He has a ton of clients because those first people he connected with, you know, have shared him with their network. And also he does good work. I mean, and it wasn't perfect at first, and he learned along the way by doing just that, you know, asking the people he was working for free with, you know, well, what do you like about these? What do you think I could do better? And then from there, he was able to build that portfolio that he could then use to get paying clients immediately.
Yep. I think free work is a great way to go. There's a lot of bashing in the design community on what people would call free or spec work. And so like contest websites like 99 Designs get a ton of flack and other things like that. But, you know, professional designers aren't going to do free work, and people starting out, it's a fantastic way to build your portfolio, get a ton of experience. And so I think people starting out should definitely do free work.
Right. Good. Now, you said that after October 2011, you left your job. And you had that you mentioned an iPad application. How did that come into play? What gave you the idea for that? What was the app, and how is it, you know, you play a role in what you're doing now?
Yeah. So when the iPad was announced in beginning of 2011, the company I worked for said, we want to have an iPad application out in the App Store the day the iPad comes out. And that presented some interesting challenges because none of us knew how to program for the iPhone or the iPad. Uh-huh. But we partnered with the company, and I got to learn along the process and do the design for it. And so we got the app out the launch day, which was a lot of fun. Got a little bit of press from it. And then that just started my journey of getting further and further into mobile development. Like the first app, I just did the visual design. So just in Photoshop, I didn't get into the code at all. And then the next app we worked on at that company, I like got into the code a little bit. And then I got my year wrong. The iPad came out in 2010, not 2011. So by middle of 2010, I like knew a little bit of code and I wanted to start building my own apps, but I didn't have any ideas. And my sister-in-law was working with a boy who had autism, and he had a nonverbal form of autism. So he had the ability to think through and create sentences, but he wouldn't verbalize them. And so there are these devices. He was using one called a Dynavox, and they cost about $7,000. And they're these ruggedized PCs. This one in particular runs Windows XP. And so you can see like the little cursor sitting on the screen. So it's a terrible touchscreen, has a half hour battery life. A power supply, you know.
Yeah.
It's terrible. And the iPad just is fantastic for that. And so not only was the hardware terrible, but the software was really bad as well. And so I was looking for a project to improve some code with to create and to practice coding with. And so I took that on as a project and just as something to build, and people really liked it.
What was the app called?
It's called One Voice, and it's actually still on the store.
One Voice?
Yeah, One Voice.
Okay.
And the first month it was out, it came out in January 2011. The first month it was out, I think it made $1,500 or $1,000, somewhere in there.
How much does the app cost?
It's a $200 app.
A $200 app?
Yeah, it's very expensive.
Okay, this is interesting because, you know, most apps are, you know, we think of apps and we think of 99 cents to $2.99. But this right. is something that is replacing something that is $7,000.
Yep, exactly.
And it's so much better. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so not only is the hardware better, which you get that for free by being on the iPad, you know, but then I took all of my design background and made a really great user experience. So it was super easy to use. I cut out a ton of features that weren't getting used in these other tools. So really intuitive, sleek and easy to use. And my thinking on the pricing was that the iPad was $500 at the time and the app was $200. At that, you know, at $700 total, I came in at 10% of the competition. Mm-hmm. And that seemed like a good place to be.
Yeah, nice. So you made $1,500 the first month. How did you, I mean, was it just random buys off of iTunes in the App Store, or did you actually market it?
There were a couple random buys, but what I did is when I launched the app, Apple lets you give out promo codes for free copies of the app. Mm-hmm. And so what I did is I went and looked up every speech language pathologist that I could find. And those would be the ones who would work with a kid and decide, you know what, you need a tool like this Dynavox or something like OneVoice. And so there are like these tiny little distribution centers all over the country. They may only sell a couple copies of an app for you, but if they know about it, you know, one of them might see 30 kids over the course of the year who would be a good fit for your app. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I emailed all of them and said, well, first I emailed them and said, would you take a look at this for me? I didn't include the promo code right away because I wanted to get a little bit of buy-in before I gave them something for free.
So then they would definitely look at it because they would appreciate that even more.
Right, because if you start off saying, here's something for free, then people like don't think there's a lot of value in it. But if you start a bit of a conversation about it and then say, let me give you a free copy once they've expressed some interest, then the perceived value is higher.
Ah, very smart.
So then the other thing I did is said, I'll give you a free copy in trade for feedback. And so then I contacted 30 speech language pathologists the first month and then continued contacting about that many every month for the next few months. Mm-hmm. And I just started getting loads of great feedback and then improving the app. It was actually a pretty, you know, feature limited and not that great of an app when it first came out. 2 months later, it was a whole lot better. You know, it's continued to do well. I think its best month, it sold $5,500 worth.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, this seems like a very, you know, sort of the lean startup model. You know, you put out something that works and you get feedback directly from the people who would use it or, you know, offer it to somebody who would use it. And you just make improvements based on that exact feedback from those people instead of just sort of guessing what it would be and creating this really feature filled thing right away. You said it was kind of, you know, it wasn't its best at first, but I think that just shows how sometimes you just need to ship it. You know, if you have an idea for something and you know it's going to be useful, you know, make it useful and then ship it and then sort of mold it from there and perfect it then. You know, a lot of people hold themselves back because they want that perfect thing right away. This is just a great example. And I think a lot of the people who are, in the App Store, and I know there's quite a few people in my audience who are, they're appreciating what you're saying right now because, you know, I haven't really talked about apps in a while as well, but also just the fact that you went out there and this is how you market it. You actually talked to people and emailed them and got direct feedback. I think a lot of people in the App Store or even people who have their own online businesses and blogs, you know, we expect to just sort of build something and let people come, you know, and find it naturally where, you know, I think a lot of people remember maybe Neil Patel's interview. I think it was number 69 or 70, I'm trying to remember. He talked about this thing called the 200, you know, marketing effort where you actually go out and if you have a blog or something useful, you go out there and you message 200, you know, you make a contact list of 200 people. It just seems like, I don't know, I don't want to say we're lazy, but sort of we are. You know, we spend all this time creating content and then we expect people to come and we don't do anything about it and we wonder why it's not getting out there. It's just because we're not putting it out there. So I really appreciate that you told us this and sort of how it worked out for you. So what happened after that? You know, the app's making $5,000 a month. I mean, what, you know, how did that feel and where did you go from there?
Yeah, so it felt great, especially when the day, so my son was born September 20th, 2011. And so I spent, you know, all day at the hospital, did not even think about money once or anything like that, you know. And that was actually a day that a school bought, I think, 35 copies of One Voice all in one bulk purchase. So the day in my life that I had made the most money, I think that works out to like $1,600 or $1,700 in profit to me, was the day that I had not even thought about a computer or money or anything. And I thought, wow, that's really, really powerful.
Yeah. I mean, that's passive income at its finest right there. And obviously, you know, you have to upkeep the app and improve it. But just the fact that you didn't have to trade that time for money, I think, I mean, that's the whole idea behind this website and this podcast. So that's so awesome that you were able to experience that on the day your son was born. I think that's just so poetic.
There's one thing about that, kind of what happened with the app next. I ran into a bit of a problem with the app, and that is that other than emailing people directly and writing some amount of content, I didn't have a great way to get new customers. So I worked moderately hard for every customer I got, relatively speaking. You know, I still had a full-time job for most of that time. And so it was just, you know, just a side thing. But part of the reason is because I wasn't a part of the industry. I wasn't a speech language pathologist. I didn't have a direct connection with anybody who really used the app. And so marketing it was quite a challenge. And I didn't know how to market it in a sustainable way, short of like buying advertising or something like that. Mm-hmm. And buying advertising for apps in the app store is weird because you can't actually track conversions. And it's a bit of this black box as far as analytics. So the app started to stagnate as I got a little bit burnt out on constantly emailing more people and this, you know, people were finding it, but it was still too much direct sales than I wanted. So it kind of tapered off over the next year, where it went from that peak of 5,500 in a month down to 4,000 and 3,000 a month. And now it's running at about 1,000 a month, but that's with me not touching it at all.
Okay. Now, do you feel like there's something you could have done better or should have done that you didn't? Besides sort of creating that sort of sustainable, I mean, how would you do that? Or is that something you could still do?
It's something I could still do, but what I realized is that I didn't have any desire to build an audience of speech language pathologists. It wasn't that industry was not actually a passion of mine. And so, you know, writing and talking about it constantly started to become a little bit tiresome compared to what I ended up doing later on with books and other training around design, which is, I guess, an important distinction, because what I learned later with when I started writing about design is the power of teaching. So when selling One Voice, I was reaching out to people and I was trying to get them to come with moderate success, you know, come and buy the application. When I started writing about design and teaching my knowledge, people started coming to me and listening. And so, you know, that's the whole inbound marketing versus like interruption or outbound marketing. Mm-hmm. And so that was a lesson that with the design books that really made a huge difference for me, is the more I taught people, the more they would listen and pay more attention to what I was saying and my products. So doing that over again, I would find someone who could talk about things relevant to that audience, and I would have them write a whole bunch of content and build an audience and teach. Yeah, but I'm a good fit for that.
Yeah, no, I think it's smart of you to sort of realize that wasn't your fit, even though it was successful and that's something you could have done. You know, you actually had this other passion that you wanted to do. I mean, I would, you know, something potentially that you could do is partner with somebody, you know, and just have them take full force on the marketing. Maybe they're in that industry already and you just split the costs, and that would sort of, you know, they would do their thing and you would do your thing, but with the purpose of just, you know, getting this in front of as many people as possible. So that's something you could do. But let's talk about sort of, so from there you decided to talk about design. So did you just like create a blog and start writing? I mean, how did that all happen?
Well, at some point I realized that all the people I admired online had blogs, and that was somewhere in there. So I created a blog, and you know, I wanted to be like the people I admired, and I started writing about random things. I think my very first blog post was about like social media security. At the time, everybody was giving up like logging into these sites that would change your Twitter avatar for you, like put some special effect on it. Mm-hmm. And they were giving up, they'd put in their username and password into these fairly sketchy looking websites just to get like a customized avatar. And so I wrote a blog post about how that was dumb and how you could take that and write a script and just, you know, go hack like thousands of Gmail accounts really, really quickly, because everybody was doing that, you know, those foolish things. And then I wrote some other blog posts on like some productivity ideas, just a whole bunch of random stuff that didn't have any theme running through it. Mm-hmm. I had a blog post that I wrote that you know, kind of went viral, and that was on, I detailed the finances and everything from One Voice. At the time, I'd made a total of $19,000 from it. Mm-hmm. And so I detailed all of that out in a blog post, and that ended up hitting the number one spot on Hacker News. It was a catchy title. I titled it How I Made $19,000 on the App Store While Learning to Code. So that got some attention, and at that point I thought, okay, I've made it as a blogger. But then of course it all fizzled out right after that.
Great.
And I kind of just meandered with my blogging for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be very common. You know, people start blogging and then some things will be a hit, some things won't, and then they talk about all these different things, even if there is a theme to the site. You know, what I really think it is, it's I mean, you're sharing that, you're sort of just discovering your voice. And mm-hmm. That's something that takes a while to do for everyone out there who has a blog, and it just sort of feels random to you. That's okay, you know, because you're sort of discovering where you're supposed to go, and you can't do that unless you start writing and just publishing stuff. And you know, the same thing happened for me on Smart Passive Income and almost every other blog. You know, you can talk to Jeff Goins from Goins Writer and how he struggled with trying to find his voice too. He has a really good post. I'll try to link to it here for everybody in the show notes. But yeah, it just takes time to find that voice. But then it looks like, and I'm on your site right now, NathanBerry.com. And there's obviously a theme here now, and you're talking about certain things, and you found that voice. When did that come about?
You know, there wasn't a single point where that came about, but it's just a gradual thing over time. Somebody about a month ago sent me an email, and they said, I went to your site, I just came across it, and instead of reading them, I read the most recent post, and then I went back and I started at the very beginning, and I read your blog from your first post all the way up to the most recent. And first I was shocked somebody would actually do that. And then I was partially horrified that somebody read those early posts. Uh-huh. But then he went on to say, like, you started out with, you know, your writing had no confidence in it. You weren't really sure if you were providing any value. And, you know, and it really showed through the writing. But he said that as he read further and further, he could see the confidence increase. He could see, you know, the value delivered from my ideas increasing. And so he said with every post, he could just see this very slight incremental improvement over time. But if I had to find one point in time where like an inflection point, mm-hmm. it was when I decided to write a book about designing iPhone applications. And so I started working on it. And when I got to the point, you know, I don't know, maybe I was a third or halfway done, where I was like, okay, I'm actually going to finish this. I put up a landing page for it and announced it to people. And so I said, I'm writing this book called The App Design Handbook. The landing page was really simple. It just had an image of a book, like a title, a couple sentences, and then an email opt-in form. And I think that's the point where for people, I changed from being this designer who wrote about anything to being somebody writing a book about this topic. I think I like the perception of my credibility and expertise changed radically at the point that I announced the book. Mm-hmm. And that landing page got shared around. I started writing. I stopped writing all the random blog posts. And I started writing blog posts really, really focused on design. And I tried to write some really in-depth stuff. You know, the average word count on my blog for each post probably went from 300 words up to more like 1,500 to 3,000 per post. Mm-hmm. So I tried to make a series of posts be you know, incredibly useful. And at the end of each one of those posts, I had an email opt-in form saying, hey, I'm writing this book about designing iPhone applications. And if you want to hear about it when it comes out, put in your email here. And that, by the time I launched, which was about 2.5 months after I put up the first landing page, I had 800 email subscribers who had said, I want to hear about your book.
Cool. So this is an ebook.
Yes, right? It's an ebook.
And you can find that on nathanberry.com. I'm actually looking at the landing page right now. It's the App Design Handbook. It looks really cool. And so I have a couple questions. When you wrote this book, and you said the landing page got shared like crazy. Like how did that happen?
It was slow over time. So I had maybe 400 Twitter followers at the time. So I tweeted about it. That didn't go very far, but it got me like maybe 30 people who put in their email address.
Okay.
And then a few more people shared it and retweeted it. I asked a couple friends to share it. And so I think through that initial activity, I picked up maybe as many as 75 email addresses mm-hmm. from it being shared around on Twitter. But then it got a little bit of traction on Hacker News, and that got me like another 100 email addresses. But sharing a landing page that just says, I'm writing this book, sign up to hear more about it. Like, you don't get a ton of value out of sharing that, you know, or there's not any inherent value. So most of the subscribers came from the blog posts where I'd write a really in-depth blog post. And then that would get shared around a lot. I wrote one that took Facebook had just redesigned their iPhone application. And it was a pretty subtle redesign. So I took it and compared it side to side and tried to draw as many design lessons from these subtle improvements as possible. Mm-hmm. And so that post is titled User Experience Lessons from the New Facebook iPhone Application. And that one, it didn't get traction on like Reddit or Hacker News like I kind of thought it would. But instead, it just got shared and shared and shared. Like, I think it had 100 tweets for it, which was a lot for me at the time, just over the course of a weekend. And people just kept sharing it. And it was timely because the app had just come out, the Facebook app. But yeah, and that got me a lot of email subscribers. So posts like that drove more subscribers than anything else.
Okay, now this is the question that I was trying to get at. It's like, okay, you at this point when you're writing this book, you created one application, right? And it was, you know, fairly successful. What qualified you to write the App Design Handbook?
Okay, yeah. So I'd actually designed quite a few other applications.
And I know I'm not asking this because I don't think you're qualified. I'm asking you this because I want people out there listening to understand how you were able to qualify to write a book like this, like the App Design Handbook. Like, how did people trust you when you weren't even originally an app designer? You know, you didn't, you know, but I mean, you've had success, but how did you get people to get into this and really see you as an authority here?
Yeah, so I guess for a little bit of backstory, that year after I left my job, that year that I spent freelancing was almost exclusively building iPhone and iPad applications for other companies. And so at that point, I designed and and done some development on probably almost 20 iPhone applications. A couple that were mine, but lots of client work. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, that actually doesn't – that improved my skill, but that doesn't demonstrate any authority.
Right.
Because a lot of those were under non-disclosure agreements, so I couldn't talk about them. I think once you have a base level of skill, so we're assuming that you're at least good at your job, then just by teaching, you start to get authority. So I think I got a lot of perceived authority just by putting out the landing page and saying, I'm going to write this book. Now, I had to quickly back that up with something. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would die out. But so I backed it up with two or three really in-depth blog posts about design and, you know, about designing iPhone applications specific to
ones that would prove pretty much that you knew what the heck you were talking about.
Yeah. And I think people think that you have to teach for years and years in order to build up authority. And that certainly helps, but really you can get it pretty quickly if your content is really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm remembering a podcast I did with Trevor Page, who has a site about programming with Java, and his very first post on his site was a sort of how to program with Java 101, like totally in depth, pages long, and he got that onto Lifehacker and was able to sell a book within, you know, just months. And that obviously, you know, people wouldn't buy that unless he had somehow proven himself. And he had done that, like you said, with just really good free stuff on his site. So I think,
I like to tell people to put out three epic blog posts. So, and they should be of the quality that they could be like a chapter out of your book. In fact, they could actually be a chapter out of your book. That would be fine. Mm-hmm. And that's really all it takes to demonstrate authority, I think, is two, three, or four really, really good in-depth blog posts. And at that point, people will start to trust you, especially when you add on there that you're writing a book on this topic.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of the niche site duel that I'm doing right now, and I'm sort of building a site in the food truck niche for food truck business owners. I mean, that's the approach I'm going to take. It's sort of inspired by Neil Patel and his strategy of just creating an ultimate sort of beastly resource. And I think that's why, you know, one that's free and one that can be shared and one that can't help but to be shared. And I think you did the mm-hmm. same thing. And I think that's the way everybody should approach it. I mean, how is mediocre content going to prove your worth? You know, you have to create something amazing. So I would love to, after we talk here, to get those links to those, you know, epic posts that you were talking about so people can check them out and sort of see sort of exactly what you had done. So you come out with the book and how did it do?
So it did very well, and it blew me away. When the book came out September 4th, 2012, and I had an email list of 800 people, and I sent out, you know, it's important to note that I built up, I stayed in touch with these people. I didn't have them sign up and then months later be like, the book's ready, buy it. Uh-huh. You know, there was, as I'd write blog posts, I'd email it to the people on the list and stay in touch with them. And so they were interested and ready to buy by the time the launch came around. But I sent out an announcement email at 6 a.m. my time. So it'd be 8 a.m. Eastern. Mm-hmm. And within 10 minutes, I had $1,000 in revenue from it. And I was just refreshing my Gumroad account, watching these new sales roll in.
Right.
And by the end of the day, the book had done $12,500.
Wow. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, it absolutely blew me away.
Now, the crazy part about here is a lot of people think that you can't make very much money from a book. You know, a traditional book, just the research I've done with a traditional book, and yours was an ebook, but as far as traditional books, I mean, people hardly make any money, even big authors. You know, they use it mostly as like a business card for their business and other things that they have to offer. But even on Kindle, I mean, and that's sort of the hot thing right now, publishing books on Kindle for between, you know, $2.99 and $9.99. I mean, I did that with Let Go, but it's not $12,500 in one day with an email list of 100 people. How did you get $12,500 in one day? You weren't on Kindle. You were selling it off of your own site.
Yeah, so I sold exclusively through my own site. I ignored Kindle, iBooks, all those other stores. And
why?
There's two reasons. One, you don't get the customer. They're Amazon's customer. They're Apple's customer. They're not yours. You have no way to contact them. You have no clue who they are.
Yeah, you're right.
that really frustrated me selling iPhone apps. You know, a school would pay me thousands of dollars to buy a whole bunch of copies of OneVoice, and all I would know about them is that they were in the United States.
And you couldn't even thank them.
I couldn't even thank them or follow up with them to see how it was going or anything.
Yeah, and you're right with the same thing with Amazon. I mean, I've sold, you know, thousands of copies of Let Go, and I only know who bought them based on who emails me afterwards.
Yep, exactly. So that's a really big reason. The other really big reason is pricing. On the iBook store, you can choose any price you want so long as it's $15 or less. And on Amazon, you can choose any price you want, but you're heavily penalized if it's not within, what, $2 and $10?
I think $1.99 and $9.99. You get 70% royalty from that. And if you go to $10 or above, you get that cut in half.
Yeah, it's rough. So those were the two big reasons. So what I ended up doing, and this is what made an absolutely huge difference in my revenue, is I priced based on the value I felt the book delivered. So I went with a base price of $39 for the book. And a lot of people do that. That's fairly common in the blogging world. And I think your readers know that. But the other thing that I did, and I got this from Chris Guillebeau, he made a passing comment about it a few months before I launched, and so I looked into it, went with multiple packages. So I priced just the book and a few little resources at $39, and then I did a middle package at $79, and that included, you know, some more Photoshop files, some templates, and some video tutorials. Mm-hmm. And then at $169, I had the top end package that included, you know, all of the above, plus code samples and more tutorials and just even more stuff. And the reason for that is different people can will get different amounts of value from your work. You know, a freelancer may implement it on a project, and their client may be a little bit happier. Whereas a designer in a larger company may implement it and, you know, implement these design changes and philosophies, and it may make the company, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or much more. Mm-hmm. If they're at a larger scale. And so they get different amounts of value, but also different people can afford to pay different amounts. So the freelancer, $39 might be a bit of a stretch, but they can afford it. But to a real business, $169 or even $400 or $500 isn't much at all. So once they've got the company credit card out, there's really no difference between $39 and $169. So if you think, is this going to provide, you know, a couple hours worth of time saved or extra value for my design team, then it's a no-brainer to go with the top-end package.
Right. Now, is this a payment structure you think anybody could use, or is it better for someone whose customers may have business type clients and, like you were saying, like designers who work for other companies and things like that, who can pull up the company credit card? Or do you feel that this is something, you know, a regular blogger could implement if they have a skill that they know they are, you know, somewhat of an expert in, that they can share with their audience, and their audience wants more information about that? Do you feel that this is better than, saying, producing a book on the Kindle platform?
I definitely, it depends on your goal. If your goal is to maximize revenue, then I definitely think so. But you could also put out a book with a different goal, like to to maximize the number of people that, that hear your message or to build your audience? Or, you know, there's a bunch of different goals in mind. My goal was to maximize revenue. And I think that's multiple packages is a great way to do that. You could even just do two packages, like just the book and then the book plus tutorials. It's easier to justify higher prices when you're selling to people who will use what you're teaching to make more money. So if you're teaching knitting, it's going to be really hard to justify a price of $169. But if you're teaching programming, marketing, design,
how to pass an exam,
yes, exactly. And that's easy, right? People can just do some math on time saved, the potential upside, and it's easy to justify that price.
Sure. So, are you potentially saying that, you know, those of us who are in the hobby niche and maybe targeting people who don't have that much money, it's going to be a little bit more difficult?
I think it's going to be more difficult to command a really premium price. But I think if you're selling a product for $20 now, I bet you could find some extras that you could package in at a higher option of, say, $40 or $50, somewhere in there. And then you'll have plenty of people who will just buy your base package. Mm-hmm. But a handful of people will buy more. So I'm going to give an example from the first 48 hours of the app design handbook. And so I had the three packages. The lowest package sold as many copies as the middle one and the top one combined. But the majority of the revenue came from the most expensive package.
Mm. Cool.
And that's constantly true. So I've run a bunch of numbers across a lot of people's books who implement the strategy, and multiple packages consistently doubles or triples your revenue.
Yep.
If you know of another method that consistently doubles or triples revenue, I'd love to hear it. But every time I've seen it implemented, it's made a radical difference in revenue.
Yeah, I mean, when I added my audio guide to my ebook on Green Exam Academy, it doubled my income pretty much. And, you know, it's just sort of a bonus to what they could already get with the ebook. And I think with the three packages, I actually think three is better. And that's something I probably could implement on Green Exam Academy. I like three because, well, depending on your audience, I mean, your audience, like you said, they have the company credit card typically, so they're going to buy the most expensive thing because that has the most useful stuff for them. And, they're okay with spending that money. But a lot of times the middle package is the one that's purchased the most because people don't want to buy they want some of the extras, but they see that, you know, higher priced top one and they're like, okay, that's a little bit too much money. I'll go for the middle one. You know, it's sort of like when people go to a restaurant and, you know, they don't want to pick the, you know, when they're on the wine list, they always pick the second most expensive or the second cheapest one. You know, they don't pick the cheapest one. They pick the second cheapest one usually.
Yeah.
Similar sort of psychology there. And I know there's a video on Derek Halpern's site, Social Triggers, that talks about these three sort of tiers that you can present to your audience. If you don't mind me asking, I mean, I would love to talk a little bit about, you know, just design in general, just for the people out there. I mean, most of the people in my audience have a website, potentially some of them have products. And I know that you specialize in app design, but I know you are really good with just web interface and design in general. I mean, I just want to ask you a general question that I hope you can sort of provide some answers to for everybody out here who has something online. You know, what makes good design? Like how important is design to what we're doing?
I think design is very important, but I think it's also a really broad term. So you can refer to it as visual design, which is, I think, what we're most often talking about. And that's moderately important. But what I mean when design is really important is think of design as being intentional about what you're doing. And in that sense, it's the most important thing. So design would be how you structure what you're offering, how you write the content, how you want it to be perceived. And that makes it insanely important. And visual design makes a big difference with credibility and drawing attention to the right things. But if I had to give like three quick ideas that will really, really improve the visual design that anybody can implement, what that would be is first fix the spacing on everything. So it'd be spacing and alignment. When you put things, when you just type them into your WordPress blog or throw together some HTML and CSS, things will just fall and land at a default place on the page, wherever they happen to be. And it's not going to line up exactly. And so if you make everything on the left edge line up and then everything on the right edge line up, and then just around each of your boxes and your call to action buttons, just make that spacing consistent, you'll see a really big difference. And you don't have to have any design skill to do that. The second thing that I would say is the most important job as a designer is to decide what's important and draw attention to that. And in doing so, you're taking attention away from things that are less important. So an example would be, say you're saving a form and like for a blog post or something in your web application. And so you've got a save button and a cancel button. Most people will give both of those buttons the same visual weight. So maybe they're both bold text and bright blue background and a gradient on them. Yeah. But really the save button is going to be clicked 95% of the time and the cancel button maybe 5% of the time. So what I want to do is give a whole bunch of visual weight to the save button and take away visual weight from the cancel button. So I might make the cancel button just an underlined link, whereas the save button retains that, you know, that bold blue background.
Mm-hmm. Now, so, does that make a difference like in the business, or is that just better for user experience? I mean, I can see where you're going with that, but why does that matter?
So it tells the user what's important, and it makes it much easier for scanning through. So it definitely makes a difference for the user experience, and you'll see that in a lot of cases manifest itself on the business side, because you can draw attention to the elements you want people to pay attention to. So whether that's buy buttons or a specific testimonial, you can control where attention goes, and that's really powerful.
Right. I mean, I'm just really interested in this right now because I'm undergoing a redesign. Actually, the redesign of SPI is done. It just needs to be coded now. And, you know, a big focus was, you know, where do we want people to look? And I think if for those of you who are on my site now before the redesign, it's just a mess right now. And, I feel like now that I've seen sort of what's coming, when I go back to my site, I hate it because I can see everything trying to fight for my attention when really there should only be, you know, one or two things. Like, you know, you want to sort of give people direction through design. And you don't even need words for that. You know, it just needs to be, like you said, those visual cues, I think.
Yeah, and I think when people say, I want to draw attention to this element or this text, they think, let's make it bold, let's make it brighter, things like that. But often you can do that and that's fine, but often a better way to draw attention is by de-emphasizing other things. So changing the less important text to be like a medium gray instead of black, making some things smaller. Because if you take away emphasis from other elements, that's going to increase the emphasis on your primary elements. So it'll make your design look a lot cleaner.
Right. I mean, I'm looking at your landing page for the App Design Handbook. It's beautiful. Everything's aligned. You know, I just flow easily and nicely down the page. And I love your payment system. And I know you're using a company that I've mentioned a couple times on the blog, but I haven't really explored it yet myself, even though I met one of the founders. It's called Gumroad. And I use eJunkie right now, and I've used it for almost 5 years now on Green Exam Academy. I wish this was around, and I know I can do. That's something on my list to sort of implement Gumroad. But it just makes the buying experience just flow with the website instead of what I have now, which is people sort of go off the site and they make a purchase and then they come back. This just sort of just makes the experience almost seamless. So I know you're a fan of Gumroad, obviously. They are doing some good things in the sort of payment system world online.
Yeah, Gumroad's fantastic. They're what they call the Gumroad modal integrates really nicely with your site, and you just click a buy button and this overlay comes up right in place. It's a super great experience to fill it out. They never leave your site.
Yeah, and they don't even ask for that much information. Like, I'm looking at yours right now. It's email, name, credit card, expiration date, and that security code on the back, and that's it.
Yep.
So, I mean, the less stuff I have to do, the more likely I am to buy this. And it just looks really, really clean. So anyone out there looking for a new sort of payment system, I would definitely recommend Gumroad. I met one of the owners, Ryan. He's great. And I'm definitely going to be exploring it in the future.
Yeah, Ryan's a good friend of mine. And I've sold all of my books on Gumroad. And I absolutely love them. Cannot recommend them enough.
How much have you made writing books now?
So the books... What are we at? We're at 10 months since September, and I've made just over $200,000.
That's awesome. Wow, Nathan, yeah, there's like so much.
It's crazy.
Like, that's just so cool because, you know, I know a lot of people want to write a book and a lot of people are looking into Amazon. You know, there's something to be said, and I have experience with this too, and to sell your book on your own site. And, you know, you didn't even have that big of an audience to start with, and a lot of people think you need that, you know, you need tens of thousands of people to be able to sort of create a sustainable business by selling a book on your own site. But this just proves otherwise. And I think, you know, everything we talked about from creating that epic content on your site to sort of validate the book that you're writing, and sort of, I think it sounded like you were sort of using the writing process, you know, the fact that you were writing a book as sort of, you know, creating buzz for it and also just validating yourself along the way and within those posts. To just the really clean experience that you have when looking at these things. It's just, you know, it can work. And I think you mentioned earlier that it really depends on what your goals are. And if your goals are to make more money, definitely explore publishing on your own this way. I mean, I don't know how much exactly Gumroad takes, but I know, you know, Amazon, if you go between the two, you know, the $1.99 and the $9.99 price, they take 30%. I know iBooks takes 30%. How much?
Gumroad takes 5%.
Gumroad takes 5. Okay, so you're making 95% profit.
Pretty much. Which is wonderful.
On a book that's much higher price.
Yes, exactly. And so one thing that people say is they'll look at my launch numbers, like the 24-hour launch numbers of, you know, $12,000 for the App Design Handbook, $26,000 for designing web apps. And they'll go, oh, that's fantastic. But then they'll overlook like the multiple packages. They'll say, that launch was really, really good. By the way, that multiple packages thing you do, I don't know if it's worse for me, you know? And I really have to point out that, no, using multiple packages doubled my revenue for the App Design Handbook, and it tripled my revenue for designing web applications. Like, and so I always have to remind people that those go hand in hand.
Right. So, I mean, you have two books. You just mentioned the App Design Handbook and the designing web applications. Which is great. And then you just recently came out with a new book, I think.
Yeah. So I took all of these ideas that worked so well for me, like how to use email to build up and how to build a launch list from nothing and all this pricing stuff and everything that I've learned about writing and publishing a book and pulled that all into a book called Authority. And that came out a month ago. And it's done really well. I think it's sitting at... like $37,000 in sales in the last month. Awesome. And obviously most of that was in the first day. Books have this habit of, at least mine do. I build up for a really big launch and then of course they drop off after that. But
Well, it's a lovely business model, Nathan. I think everybody should visit your site, nathanberry.com, and just see what you have going on. You have great content on your blog and it just looks really good. And, you know, I'm really excited for you and your future. I know even better things are going to happen. So I think for everybody out there, you know, just you know, this is very inspiring, but also just look at the tactics that he's using. And it's just you know, I haven't really seen anyone doing it quite like this and doing it this well. So congratulations, Nathan. It's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. The last thing, like, to follow those tactics, I actually put, I kind of wrote down everything that I did and put it into a free email course. It's just called Mastering Product Launches. And if you go to nathanberry.com/launch, that's on there. It's all free. And it's basically everything I know about launching products, put it spread out over 4 weeks. So sent for free.
Cool, man. And that includes, is that like info products or is that, you know, apps or what kind of products are you talking about?
You know, it works for all kinds of products. Most of my experience is with info products, but also for iPhone apps and web apps is what I've used it for.
Cool. I'll definitely link to that in the show notes. Thank you so much, Nathan, for your time. I know a lot of people got, you know, a lot of great stuff out of this and might look at their business in a different way as a result. So thank you for that. And, you know, just wishing you all the best. You know, is there any place other than Nathan Berry you want people to check out? NathanBerry.com?
Nope. That's it.
All right, man. Sounds good. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks.
Bye. All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Nathan Berry from NathanBerry.com. Berry is spelled B-A-R-R-Y. And yeah, just Nathan, if you're listening to this, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom. I am definitely inspired and I can't wait to get my hands on Gumroad. That's G-U-M, like chewing gum, road.com. I actually had lunch with Ryan Delk from Gumroad. He was in San Diego and we met for a coffee and we had just an amazing conversation. I got to learn a lot about the company and how amazing it is and how they're pushing so much stuff forward and into the future as far as digital delivery is concerned and doing all this incredible stuff that I never even heard of before. So if you're doing any sort of digital delivery of goods and want to get paid for it like Nathan does, definitely check out Gumroad. I promise I'm going to be using it in the future very soon. I also want to mention briefly a course that I just came out with. It's not open right now, actually. It was open only for 3 days at the beginning of July, but it is going really, really well. I'm working with the members inside right now to make it even better for a reopening later this year, sometime later this year. But if you're interested, head on over to breakthroughblogging.com. You can watch the video there and also sign up for notification when it gets reopened. And you know, there's going to be a special deal for those of you there on that particular email list. And yeah, I just wanted to mention that because I'm just really, really proud of that particular product. Again, that's my first sort of membership site, and I'm working with the people in there right now just to make it even better, and I'm just so excited for it. So yeah, that's all I want to mention about that. Again, show notes are always available for these episodes. This one is session 75, so you can go to smartpassiveincome.com/session75 and get the show notes there and the resources and all the links mentioned in this episode. And lastly, I appreciate you so much, all the reviews on iTunes, good and bad. They are so helpful. I think we're up to like 922 five-star reviews or something ridiculous like that, which is awesome. I'm trying to get to 1,000 by the end of the year, and it looks like we're going to make it. Just passed 75,000 subscribers on the blog, just passed 4 million downloads of the podcast. And that's all because of you. So just thank you so much. I owe you one. And I can't wait to bring you the next episode next week. So thank you so much. Have an amazing day and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Passive Income Podcast at www.smartpassiveincome.com.
Entrepreneurs, what is the smart way to save when your growing business takes you on the road? Whether you're going to events or conventions or you're speaking somewhere, no matter what it is, you need to sign up for a free membership with Hertz Business Rewards. Yep, Hertz Rental Car created a program to help small and mid-sized businesses save money. Work trips, client meetings, industry conferences. With Hertz Business Rewards, you save at least 20% every time you rent a car. And you'll save on more than just the daily rate. Members earn credits redeemable toward free rental days, and it's also free to add an additional driver if any additional coworkers come along. And for those Gen Z entrepreneurs out there, no young renter fees. Plus, sign up for Hertz Business Rewards today and earn 3x credit during your first 90 days. These benefits add up to big savings that stack more dollars in your wallet. Join for free at Hertz.com/businessrewards. applies to base rate, taxes, fees, and options excluded. Additional terms and exclusions apply. Visit hertz.com/business rewards to learn more. Hey there, and thanks for sticking around to the end. If you're looking for more great shows like this one, definitely give How Success Happens a listen. Another great show from the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. On How Success Happens, Robert Tuchman features some of today's brightest entrepreneurial minds talking about overcoming challenges and viewing them as learning experiences to create success. The challenges that entrepreneurs face are ultimately what make many of us successful, however we define success, and that's what the show is all about. There's lots of names you'll surely recognize on the show every single week. Just recently, Robert had Nasty Gal CEO Sophia Amoruso on the show, and the former CEO of Snapple the week before that, which is really awesome. So listen to How Success Happens right now on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or Stitcher.